The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 8, Side 1.
So that was it. A regrouping. Guards were posted by the break in the Chinese wall. It would be bricked up next day. We were taken past the guardhouse and herded, hundreds of us, with sacks and mattresses, like refugees from a burning village, around the boundary fence, past another guardhouse, into the other camp area, passing those who were being driven in the opposite direction. All minds were busily trying to work out who had been moved, who had been left behind, what this reshuffle meant. What our masters had in mind became clear soon enough. In one half of the camp, Camp Division Number 2, only the Ukrainian nationalists, some 2,000 of them, were left. In the half to which we had been driven, and which was to be Camp Division Number 1, there were some 3,500 men belonging to all the other ethnic groups, Russians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Latvians, Tatars, Caucasians, Georgians, Armenians, Jews, Poles, Moldavians, Germans, and a variegated sprinkling of other nationalities picked up from the expanses of Europe and Asia. In a word, our country, one and indivisible. Curious this, the thinking of the MVD, which should have been enlightened by a supranational doctrine called socialism, still followed the same old track, that of dividing nation from nation. The old teams were broken up, new ones were mustered. They would go to new work sites, live in new huts. In short, a complete reshuffle. There was enough to think about here for a week, not just one Sunday. Many links were snapped, people were thrown together in different combinations, and the strike, which had seemed imminent, was broken in advance. Oh, they were clever. The whole hospital, the mess hall, and the club remained in the Ukrainian camp division. We were left instead with the camp jail, while the Ukrainians, the banderists, the most dangerous rebels, had been moved farther away from it. What did this mean? We soon learned what. Reliable rumors went around the camp, from the working prisoners who took the gruel to the BUR, that the stoolies in the safe deposit had grown cheeky. Suspects, picked up here and there, two or three at a time, had been put in with the stoolies who were torturing them in the common cell, choking them, beating them, trying to make them sing and to name names. Who's doing the slashing? This made the whole scheme as clear as daylight. They were using torture. Not the dog pack themselves. They probably had no authorization for it and might run into trouble. So they had entrusted the stoolies with the job. Find your murderers yourselves. The stoolies were all eagerness, no shot in the arm needed. And this was one way for those parasites to earn their keep. That was why the banderists had been moved away from the BUR, so that they could not attack it. We were less of a worry. Docile people of different races, we would not make common cause. The rebels were in the other place, and the wall was 4 meters high. So many deep historians have written so many clever books, and still they have not learned how to predict those mysterious conflagrations of the human spirit, to detect the mysterious springs of a social explosion, nor even to explain them in retrospect. Sometimes you can stuff bundle after bundle of burning tow under the logs, and they will not take. Yet up above, a solitary little spark flies out of the chimney and the whole village is reduced to ashes. Our 3,000 had no plans made, were quite unprepared, but one evening on their return from work, the prisoners in a hut next to the BUR began dismantling their bunks, seized the long bars and cross pieces, ran through the gloom, there was a darkish place on one side of the BUR, to batter down the stout fence around the camp jail. They had neither axes nor crowbars, because there never are any inside the camp area, unless perhaps they had begged a couple from the maintenance yard. There was a hammering noise, they worked like a team of good carpenters, levering the planks away as soon as they gave, and the grating protests of 12-centimeter nails could be heard all over the camp. It was hardly the time for carpenters to be working, but at least it was a workmanlike noise, and at first neither the men on the towers, nor the warders, nor the other prisoners, thought anything of it. Life was following its usual evening routine. Some teams were going to supper, others straggling back from supper, some making for the medical section, others for the stores, others for the parcels office. All the same, the warders were worried, hustled over to the BUR, to the half-dark wall where all the activity was, and raced like scalded cats to the staff barracks. Somebody rushed after a warder with a stick. Then, to provide full musical accompaniment, somebody started breaking windows in the staff barracks with stones or a stick. The staff's window panes shattered with a merry, menacing crash. What the lads had in mind was not to raise a rebellion, nor even to capture the BUR, no easy matter, but merely to pour petrol into the stoolie's cell and toss in something burning, meaning, watch your step, we'll show you yet. A dozen men did force their way through the gap knocked in the BUR fence. They started tearing around, looking for the cell. They had made a guess at the window, but were not sure. Then they had to dislodge the muzzle, give someone a leg up, pass the petrol pail. But machine gun fire from the towers suddenly rattled across the camp, and they never did start their blaze. The warders and Chief Disciplinary Officer Machikovsky had fled from the camp and informed division. Machikovsky, too, had been pursued by a prisoner with a knife, had run by way of the shed in the maintenance yard to a corner tower, shouting, "You in the tower! Don't fire! I'm a friend!" and scrambled through the outer fence. He was hacked to pieces just the same, not, however, by us, but by the thieves who replaced us in Ekibastutz in 1954. He was harsh, but courageous. There's no denying that. Division, where can we now inquire the names of the commanders, gave telephonic instructions for the corner towers to open fire from machine guns on 3,000 unarmed people who knew nothing of what had happened. Our team, for instance, was in the mess hall, and we were completely mystified when we heard all the shooting outside. It was one of fate's little jokes that this took place on January the 22nd, new style, January the 9th, old style, the anniversary of Bloody Sunday, which until that year was marked in the calendar as a day of solemn mourning. For us it proved to be Bloody Tuesday, and the butchers had much more elbow room than in Petersburg. This was not a city square, but the steppe, with no witnesses, no journalists, or foreigners around. But it is interesting to note that it was about this time that Soviet calendars stopped marking Bloody Sunday, as though it was, after all, a fairly ordinary occurrence and not worth commemorating. Firing at random in the darkness, the machine gunners blasted away at the camp area. True, the shooting did not last long, and most of the bullets probably passed overhead, but quite a few of them were lower, and how many does a man need? They pierced the flimsy walls of the huts, and as always happens, wounded not those who had stormed the BUR, but others who had no part in it. Nonetheless, they now had to conceal their wounds, stay away from the medical section, wait like dogs for time to heal them, otherwise they might be identified as participants in the mutiny. Somebody, after all, must be plucked out of the faceless mass. In hut number 9, a harmless old man, nearing the end of a 10-year sentence, was killed in his bed. He was due to be released in a month's time. His grown-up sons were serving in the same army as those who blazed away at us from the towers. The besiegers left the prison yard and quickly dispersed to their barracks, where they had to put their bunks together again so as to cover their traces. Many others took the shooting as a warning to stay inside their huts. Yet others, on the contrary, poured out excitedly and scurried about the camp, trying to understand what it was all about. By then, there were no warders left in the camp area. The staff barracks was empty of officers, and terrible jagged holes yawned in its windows. The towers were silent. The curious and the seekers after truth roamed the camp. Suddenly, the gates of our camp division were flung wide, and a platoon of convoy troops marched in with Tommy guns at the ready, firing short bursts at random. They fanned out in all directions, and behind them came the enraged warders with lengths of iron pipe, clubs, or anything else they had been able to lay their hands on. They advanced in waves on every hut, combing the whole camp area. Then the Tommy gunners were silent and halted while the warders ran forward to flush out prisoners in hiding, whether wounded or unhurt, and beat them unmercifully. All this became clear later, but at the time, we could only hear heavy firing in the camp area and could see and understand nothing in the half-dark. A lethal crush developed at the entrance to our hut. The prisoners were so anxious to shove their way in that no one could enter. Not that the thin boards of the hut walls gave any protection against bullets, but once inside, a man ceased to be a mutineer. I was one of those by the steps. I remember very well my state of mind, a nauseated indifference to my fate, a momentary indifference whether I survived or not. Why have you fastened your hooks on us, curse you? Why must we go on paying you till the day we die for the crime of being born into this unhappy world? Why must we sit forever in your jails? The prison sickness, which is at once nausea and peace of mind, flooded my being. Even my constant fear for the as yet unrecorded poem and the play I carried within me was in abeyance. In full view of the death which was wheeling towards us in military greatcoats, I made no effort at all to push through the door. This was the true convict mentality. This was what they had brought us to. The doorway gradually cleared, and I was among the last to go through. Shots rang out at this point, amplified by the hollow building. The three bullets they fired after us lodged in a row in the door jamb. A fourth ricocheted upward and left a little round hole haloed with hairline cracks in the glass above the door. Our pursuers did not break into the huts. They locked us in. They hunted down and beat those who had not been quick enough to run inside. A couple of dozen prisoners were wounded or badly beaten. Some lay low and hid their wounds. Others were passed to the medical section for a start, with jail and interrogation as participants in a mutiny to follow. But all this became known only later. The doors were locked overnight, and on the following morning the inmates of different huts were not allowed to meet in the mess hall and piece the story together. In some huts, where no one was seen to be hurt and nothing was known about the killings, the deluded prisoners turned out to work. Our hut was one of them. Out we went, but no one was led through the camp gates after us. The midway was empty. There was no work line-up. We had been tricked. We felt wretched in the engineering shops that day. The lads went from bench to bench and sat down to discuss what had happened the day before and how long we would go on working like donkeys and tamely putting up with it all. Camp veterans, who would never straighten their backs again, were skeptical. What else could we do, they asked. Did we suppose that anyone had ever survived, unbroken? This was the philosophy of the 1937 draft. When we returned from work in the dark, the camp area was again deserted. Our scouts ran to the windows of other huts. They found that number 9, in which there were 2 dead men and 3 wounded, and the huts next to it, had not gone to work. The bosses had told them about us, hoping that they too would turn out tomorrow. But the way things were, we should obviously not be going in the morning ourselves. Notes were tossed over the wall, telling the Ukrainians what we had decided, and asking for their support. The work stoppage hunger strike had not been carefully prepared. It was not even a coherent concept. And it began impulsively with no directing center, no signal system. Those prisoners in other camps who took over the food stores and then stayed away from work, of course, behaved more sensibly. But our action, if not very clever, was impressive. 3,000 men simultaneously swore off both food and work. Next morning, not a single team sent its man to the bread-cutting room. Not a single team went to the mess hall where broth and mush awaited them. The warders just could not understand it. Twice, 3 times, 4 times. They came into the huts to summon us with brisk commands, then to drive us out with threats. Then to ask us nicely, no farther than to the mess hall to collect our bread, with never a word for the present about work line-up. But nobody went. They all lay on their bunks, fully dressed, wearing their shoes, and silent. Only we, the 4 men, I had become a foreman in that hot year, felt called upon to answer, since the warders kept addressing themselves to us. We lay on our bunks like the rest and muttered from our pillows, "It's no good, boss." This unanimous quiet defiance of a power which never forgave, this obstinate, painfully protracted insubordination, was somehow more frightening than running and yelling as the bullets fly. In the end, they stopped coaxing us and locked up the huts. In the days that followed, no one left the huts except the orderlies to carry the latrine buckets out and bring drinking water and coal in. Only bed cases in the medical section were by general agreement allowed not to fast. Only doctors and medical orderlies were allowed to work. The kitchens cooked one meal and poured it away, cooked another, poured that away. and cooked no more. The trustees who worked there seemed to have appeared before the camp authorities on the first day, explained that they simply couldn't carry on, and left the kitchens. The bosses could no longer see us, no longer peer into our souls. A gulf had opened between the overseers and the slaves. None of those who took part will ever forget those 3 days in our lives. We could not see our comrades in other huts, nor the corpses lying there unburied. Nonetheless, the bonds which united us at opposite ends of the deserted camp were of steel. This was a hunger strike called not by well-fed people with reserves of subcutaneous fat, but by gaunt, emaciated men who had felt the whip of hunger daily for years on end, who had achieved with difficulty some sort of physical equilibrium, and who suffered acute distress if they were deprived of a single 100-gram ration. Even the goners starved with the rest, although a 3-day fast might tip them into irreversible and fatal decline. The food which we had refused, and which we had always thought so beggarly, was a mirage of plenty in the feverish dreams of famished men. This was a hunger strike called by men schooled for decades in the law of the jungle. You die first and I'll die later. Now they were reborn. They struggled out of their stinking swamp. They consented to die today, all of them together, rather than to go on living in the same way tomorrow. In the huts, roommates began to treat each other with a sort of ceremonious affection. Whatever scraps of food anyone, this meant mainly those who received parcels, had left, were pooled, placed on a piece of rag spread out like a tablecloth, and then, by joint decision of the whole room, some eatables were shared out and others put aside for the next day. Recipients of parcels might also have quite a bit of food in the personal provision store, but for one thing, no one could cross the camp to fetch it, and for another, not everyone would have been happy to bring his leftovers back with him. He might be counting on them to build him up when the strike was over. For this reason, the strike, like everything that happened in prison, was an unequal ordeal, and the truly brave were those who had nothing in reserve, no hope of recruiting their strength after the strike. If there was any meal, they boiled it at the mouth of the stove and distributed the gruel by the spoonful. To make the fire hotter, they broke planks off the bunks. The couch, provided by the state, is gone, but who cares when his life may not last the night? What the bosses would do, no one could predict. We thought that perhaps they would start firing on the huts again from the towers. The last thing we expected was any concession. We had never in our lives wrested anything from them, and our strike had the bitter tang of hopelessness. But there was a sort of satisfaction in this feeling of hopelessness. We had taken a futile, a desperate step. It could only end badly, and that was good. Our bellies were empty, our hearts were in our boots, but some higher need was being satisfied. During those long, hungry days, evenings, nights, 3,000 men brooded over their 3,000 sentences, their families, their lack of families, all that had befallen and would yet befall them, and although the hearts in thousands of breasts could not beat together, and there were those who felt only regret, only despair, yet most of them kept time. Things are as they should be. We'll keep it up to spite you. Things are bad. So much the better. This, too, is a phenomenon which has never been adequately studied. We do not know the law that governs sudden surges of mass emotion in defiance of all reason. I felt this soaring emotion myself. I had only one more year of my sentence to serve. I might have been expected to feel nothing but dismay and vexation that I was dirtying my hands on a broil from which I should hardly escape without a new sentence. And yet I had no regrets. Damn and blast the lot of you, I'll serve my time all over again, if you like. Next day we saw from our windows a group of officers making their way from hut to hut. A detail of warders opened the door, went along the corridors, looked into the rooms and called us, not in the old way as though we were cattle, but gently. 4 men, you're wanted at the entrance. A debate began among us. It was the teams, not their foremen, who had to decide. Men went from room to room to talk it over. Our position was ambiguous. Stoolies had been weeded out from our ranks, but we suspected that there were others, and there were certainly some, like the slippery, bold-faced foreman mechanic, Mikhail Generalov. And anyway, knowledge of human nature told us that many of those on strike and starving for freedom's sake today would spill the beans tomorrow for the sake of a quiet life in chains. For this reason, those who were steering the strike, and there were leaders, of course, did not show themselves, but remained underground. They did not openly assume power, and the foremen had openly resigned their authority, so that the strikers seemed to be drifting without a helmsman. A decision was reached at last in some invisible quarter. We foremen, six or seven of us, went out to the entrance where the officers were patiently awaiting us. It was the entranceway of that very same hut, number two, until recently a disciplinary barracks, from which the metro tunnel had run, and the escape hatch itself was a few meters away from the place where we now met. We leaned back against the walls, lowered our eyes, and stood like men of stone. We lowered our eyes because not one of us could now look at our bosses sycophantically, and rebellious looks would have been foolish. We stood like hardened hooligans called before a teacher's meeting, hunched, hands in pockets, heads lowered and averted, incorrigible, impenetrable, hopeless. From both corridors, however, a crowd of Zeks pressed into the entranceway, and hiding behind those in front, the back rows could speak freely, call out our demands and our answers. Officially, the officers with blue-edged epaulettes, some we knew, others we had never seen before, saw and addressed only the foremen. Their manner was restrained. They did not try to intimidate us, but their tone was still intended to remind us that we were inferior. It would, so they said, be in our own interest to end the strike and the hunger strike. If we did, we would receive not only today's rations, but, something unheard of in Gulag, yesterday's too. They were so used to the idea that hungry men can always be bought. Nothing was said either about punishment or about our demands. They might not have existed. The warders stood at the sides, keeping their right hands in their pockets. There were shouts from the corridor. Whoever's to blame for the shooting must be brought to justice. Take the locks off the doors. Off with the numbers. In other huts, they also demanded a review of a special board cases in the open courts. While we foremen stood like schoolboy hooligans waiting for the headmaster to finish nagging. The bosses left, and the hut was locked up again. Although hunger had begun to get many of us down, our heads were heavy and our thoughts lacked clarity, in our hut not a single voice was raised in favour of surrender. Any regrets remained unspoken. We tried to guess how high the news of our rebellion would go. They knew already, of course, in the Ministry of Internal Affairs, or would learn today. But did Whiskers? That butcher wouldn't stop at shooting the lot of us, all 5,000. Toward evening, we heard the drone of a plane somewhere near, although it was cloudy and not good flying weather. We surmised that someone even higher up had flown in. A seasoned son of Gulag, Nikolai Klebunov, who was friendly with some of us, had landed a job somewhere in the kitchens after 19 years in prison, and as he passed through the camp that day, he was quick enough and brave enough to slip us a half-pooed sack of millet flour through the window. It was shared out between the 7 teams, and cooked at night, so that the warders couldn't catch us at it. Klebunov passed on some very bad news. Camp Division Number 2, where the Ukrainians were, beyond the Chinese wall, had not supported us. That day and the day before, the Ukrainians had turned out to work as though things were quite normal. There could be no doubt that they had received our notes. They could hear how quiet we had been for 2 days. They could see from the tower crane on the building site that our camp area had been deserted since the shooting. They must have missed meeting our columns outside the camp. Nevertheless, they had not supported us. We learned afterward that the young men who were their leaders, and who still had no experience of practical politics, had argued that the Ukrainians had their own destiny, distinct from that of the Muscovites. They who had begun with such spirit had now fallen back and abandoned us, so that there were not 5,000 of us, but only 3. For the second night, the third morning, and the third day, hunger clawed at our guts. But when on the third morning the Czechists, in still greater force, again summoned the foremen to the entrance, and once again we stood there, sullen, unreachable, hangdog, Our general resolve was not to give way. We were carried along by inertial force. The bosses only gave us new strength. The newly arrived brass hat had this to say: "The administration of the Peshchani camp requests the prisoners to take their food. The administration will receive any complaints. It will examine them and eliminate the causes of conflict between the administration and the prisoners." Had our ears deceived us? They were requesting us to take food, and not so much as a word about work. We had stormed the camp jail, broken windows and lamps, chased warders with knives, and it now turned out that far from being a mutiny, this was a conflict between equals, between the administration and the prisoners. It had taken only 2 days and 2 nights of united action, and look how our serf masters had changed their tone. Never in our lives, not only as prisoners, but as free men, as members of trade unions, had we heard our bosses speak with such unction. Nonetheless, we started silently dispersing. No one could take a decision there, nor could anyone there promise a decision. The four men went away without once raising their eyes or looking around, even when the head of the separate campsite addressed us one after another by name. That was our answer. The hut was locked again. From outside it looked to the bosses as dumb and unyielding as ever, but inside the sections were the scene of stormy debate. The temptation was too great. Soft speech had affected the undemanding Zeks more than any threat would. Voices were heard urging surrender. What more, indeed, could we hope to achieve? We were tired, we were hungry. The mysterious force which had fused our emotions and borne us aloft was losing height, and with tremulous wings bringing us down to earth again. Yet mouths clamped tight for decades, mouths which had been silent for a lifetime and should have stayed silent for what was left of it, were now opened. Among those listening to them, of course, were the surviving stoolies. These exhortations in voices suddenly recovered for a few minutes, voices with a new ring to them. In our room, that of Dmitri Panin would have to be paid for by a fresh term of imprisonment, a noose around the throat in which the pulse of freedom had fluttered. It was a price worth paying, for the vocal cords were for the first time put to the use for which they were created. Give way now? That would mean accepting someone's word of honour. Whose word, exactly? That of our jailers, the camp dog pack? In all the time that prisons had existed, in all the time the camps had been there, had they ever once kept their word? The sediment of ancient sufferings and wrongs and insults was stirred up anew. For the first time ever we had taken the right road. Were we to give in so soon? For the first time we had felt what it was like to be human, only to give in so quickly? A keen, a bracing breeze of mischief blew around us. We would go on. We would go on. They'd sing a different tune before we finished. They would give way. But when would we ever be able to believe anything they said? This was as unclear as ever. That is the fate of the oppressed. They are forced to believe and to yield. Once more the emotions of 200 men were fused in a single passion. The wings of the eagle beat the air. He sailed aloft. We lay down to conserve our strength, trying to move as little as possible and not to talk unnecessarily. Our thoughts were quite enough to occupy us. The last crumbs in the hut had been finished long ago. No one had anything to cook or to share. In the general silence and stillness, the only sound was the voices of young observers glued to the windows. They told us about all the comings and goings outside in the camp. We admired these 20-year-olds, their enthusiasm undimmed by hunger, their determination to die on the threshold of life, with everything still before them, rather than surrender. We were envious of them, because the truth had entered our heads so late, and our spines were already setting in a servile arc. I can, I think, now mention by name Yanak Baranovsky, Volodya Tromfimov, and Bogdan, the metal worker. Suddenly, in the late afternoon of the third day, when the western sky was clearing and the setting sun could be seen, our observers shouted in anger and dismay, "Hut 9! 9 has surrendered! 9's going to the mess hall!" We all jumped up. Prisoners from the other side of the corridor ran into our room. Through the bars from the upper and lower bed platforms, some of us on all fours, some looking over other people's shoulders, we watched, trembling. transfixed, that sad procession. 250 pathetic little figures, darker than ever against the sunset, cowed and crestfallen, were trailing slantwise across the camp. On they went, each of them glimpsed briefly in the rays of the setting sun, a dawdling, endless chain, as though those behind regretted that the foremost had set out, and were loath to follow. Some, feebler than the rest, were led by the arm or the hand, and so uncertain were their steps that they looked like blind men with their guides. Many, too, held mess tins or mugs in their hands, and this mean prisonware, carried in expectation of a supper too copious to gulp down onto constricted stomachs, these tins and cups, held out like begging bowls, were more degrading and slavish and pitiable than anything else about them. I felt myself weeping. I glanced at my companions as I wiped away my tears, and saw theirs. Hut, number 9, had spoken, and decided for us all. It was there that the dead had been lying around for 4 days since Tuesday evening. They went into the mess hall, and it was as though they had decided to forgive the murderers in return for their bread ration and some mush. Number 9 was a hungry hut. The teams in it were all general labourers, and very few prisoners received parcels. There were many goners among them. Perhaps they had surrendered for fear that there would be other corpses. We went away from the windows without a word. It was then that I learned the meaning of Polish pride and understood their recklessly brave rebellions. The Polish engineer, Jerzy Wegierski, whom I have mentioned before, was now in our team. He was serving his 9th and last year. Even when he was a worker signer, no one had ever heard him raise his voice. He was always quiet, polite, and gentle. But now, his face was distorted with rage, scorn, and suffering as he tore his eyes away from that procession of beggars and cried in an angry, steely voice, "Foreman, don't wake me for supper. I shan't be going." He clambered up onto the top bunk, turned his face to the wall, and didn't get up again. That night we went to eat, but he wouldn't get up. He never received parcels. He was quite alone. He was always short of food. But he wouldn't get up. In his mind's eye, the steam from a bowl of mush could not veil the ideal of freedom. If we had all been so proud and so strong, what tyrant could have held out against us? The following day, January the 27th, was a Sunday. They didn't drive us out to work to make up for lost time, although the bosses, of course, were itching to get back on schedule, but simply fed us, issued arrears of rations, and let us wander about the camp. We all went from hut to hut, telling each other how we had felt in the past few days, and we were all in holiday mood, as though we had won instead of losing. Besides, our kind masters promised yet again that all legitimate requests, but who knew, who was to define what was legitimate, would be satisfied. There was, however, one untoward little event. A certain Volodka Ponomarev, a bitch, who had been with us throughout the strike, heard many rash speeches and looked into many eyes, ran away to the guardhouse, which meant that he had run to betray us outside the camp area, where he could avoid the knife. For me, the whole essence of the criminal world crystallized in Ponomarev's flight. Their alleged nobility is just a matter of caste obligations, but when they find themselves in the whirlpool of revolution, they inevitably behave treacherously. They can understand no principles, only brute force. It was an easy guess that our bosses were getting ready to arrest the ringleaders, but they announced that, on the contrary, commissions of inquiry had arrived from Karaganda, Alma-Ata, and Moscow to look into things. A table was placed on ground, stiff with hoarfrost, in the middle of the camp, where we lined up for work assignment, and some high-ranking officers sat at it in sheepskin coats and felt boots, and invited us to come forward with our complaints. Many prisoners went and talked to them. Notes were taken. After work on Tuesday, they assembled the four men to present complaints. In reality, this conference was another low trick, a form of interrogation. They knew that the prisoners were boiling with resentment and let them vent it so that they could be sure of arresting the right people. This was my last day as a foreman. My neglected tumor was growing rapidly, and for a long time now I'd been putting off my operation until, in camp terms, it was convenient. In January, and particularly during the fatal days of the hunger strike, The tumor decided for me that it was now convenient, and it seemed to get bigger by the hour. The moment the huts were opened, I showed myself to the doctors, and they set a date for the operation. But I dragged myself to this last conference. It was convened in the spacious anteroom to the bathhouse. They placed the presidium's table in front of the barber's chairs, and seated at it were one MVD colonel, several lieutenant colonels, and some smaller fry, with our camp commanders inconspicuous in the second row behind them. There, too, behind the backs of the presidium, sat the note-takers, making hasty notes throughout the meeting, while the front row helped them by repeating the names of speakers. One man stood out from the rest, a certain lieutenant colonel from the special section or from the organs, a quick, clever, nimble-witted villain, with a tall brow and a long face. This quick-wittedness, these narrow features, somehow made it difficult to believe that he belonged to that pack of obtuse police officials. The four men were reluctant to come forward, and practically had to be dragged to their feet from the close-packed benches. As soon as they started saying something of their own, they were interrupted and invited to explain why people were being murdered, and what were the aims of the strikers. And if a hapless foreman tried to give some sort of answer to the questions, reason for murders, nature of demands, the whole pack at once flung itself upon him. "And how do you know that? So you're connected with these gangsters. Right, let's have their names." This was their idea of a fair and honourable inquiry into the legitimacy of our demands. The lofty-browed villain of a lieutenant colonel was especially quick to interrupt the speakers. He had a nimble tongue and the advantage of impunity. With his caustic interjections, he thwarted each of our attempts to present our case. From the tone which the proceedings were beginning to take, you would have thought that only we faced any charges and needed to defend ourselves. An urge to put a stop to this swelled inside me. I took the floor and gave my name, which was repeated for the note-taker. I rose from the bench, pretty certain there was no one in that gathering who could trot out a rounded sentence more easily than I. The only difficulty was that I had no idea what to tell them. All that is written in these pages, all that we had gone through, all that we had brooded over in all those years and all those days on hunger strike, I might as well try telling it to orangutans as to them. They were still in some formal sense Russians, still more or less capable of understanding fairly simple Russian phrases, such as permission to enter, permission to speak, sir. But as they sat there all in a row at the long table, exhibiting their sleek, white, complacent, uniformly blank physiognomies, it was plain that they had long ago degenerated into a distinct biological type, that verbal communication between us had broken down beyond repair, and that we could exchange only bullets. Only the long-headed one had not yet turned into an orangutan. His hearing and understanding were excellent. The moment I spoke, he tried to interrupt me. With the whole audience paying close attention, a duel of lightning-swift repartee began. "Where do you work?" What difference could that make, I wonder? "In the engineering shops," I rapped out over my shoulder, and hurried on with more important things. He came straight back at me. "Where they make the knives?" "No," I said, parrying his thrust. "Where they repair self-propelled excavators." I don't know myself how my mind worked so quickly and clearly. "Hurry, hurry, make them be quiet and listen. That's the main thing." The brute crouched behind the table and suddenly pounced to sink his fangs in me. "You are here because the bandits delegated you." "No, because you invited me," I snapped back triumphantly, and went on talking and talking. He sprang at me once or twice more, was beaten off, and sat completely silent. I had won. Won, but to what purpose? Just one more year? One more year to go, and the thought crushed me. I could not get out the words they deserved to hear. I could have delivered there and then an immortal speech, and been shot next day. I would have delivered it just the same, if they had been broadcasting it throughout the world. But no, the audience was too small. So I did not tell them that our camps followed the fascist model and were a symptom of the regime's degeneration. I limited myself to waving a kerosene-soaked rag under their eagerly sniffing noses. I had learned that the commander of convoy troops was sitting there, and so I deplored the unworthy conduct of the camp guards, who had ceased to resemble Soviet fighting men, who joined in pilfering from work sites, and they were boors and bullies, and they were murderers into the bargain. Then I portrayed the warders in the camps as a gang of greedy rogues who forced Zeks to steal building materials for them. This is quite true, except that it started with the officers sitting and listening to me. And what a counter-educational effect all this had, I said, on prisoners desirous of amendment. I didn't like my speech myself. The only good thing about it was that we were now setting the pace. In the interval of silence which I had won, one of the four men, T, rose and spoke slowly, almost inarticulately, whether because that was natural to him or because he was extremely agitated. I used to agree when other prisoners said, "We live like dogs." The brute in the presidium bristled. T kneaded the cap in his hands, an ugly, crop-headed convict, his coarsened features contorted by his struggle to find the right words. "But now I see that I was wrong." The brute's face cleared. "We live much worse than dogs," T rapped out with sudden emphasis. And all the four men sat bolt upright. "A dog has only one number on his collar. We have four. Dogs are fed on meat. We're fed on fish bones. A dog doesn't get put in the cooler. A dog doesn't get shot at from watchtowers. Dogs don't get 25ers pinned on them." They could interrupt whenever they liked now. He had said all that mattered. Chernogorov rose, introducing himself as a hero of the Soviet Union. Then another foreman, and both of them spoke boldly and passionately. Their names were echoed in the presidium with heavy significance. "Maybe this can only lead to our destruction, lads, and maybe it is only by banging our heads against it that we can bring this accursed wall down." The meeting ended in a draw. All was quiet for a few days. The commission was seen no more, and life was so peaceful in our camp division that there might never have been any trouble. An escort took me off to hospital on the Ukrainian side. I was the first to be taken there since the hunger strike, the first swallow. Yanchenko, the surgeon who was to operate on me, had called me in for examination, but his questions and my answers were not about my tumor. He was not interested in my tumor, and I was glad to have such a reliable doctor. There was no end to his questions. His face was dark with the pain we all shared. The same experience in different lives can be seen in very different perspectives. This tumor, which was to all appearances malignant, what a blow it would have been if I were a free man, how I should have suffered, how my loved ones would have wept. But in this place, where heads were so casually severed from trunks, the same tumor was just an excuse to stay in bed, and I didn't give it much thought. I was lying in the hospital among those wounded and maimed on that bloody night. There were men beaten by the warders to a bloody pulp. They had nothing left to lie on. Their flesh was in ribbons. One burly warder had been particularly brutal with his length of iron piping. Memory, I cannot now recall his name. One man had already died of his wounds. News came in thick and fast. The punitive operation had begun in the Russian camp division. 40 men had been arrested. For fear of a fresh mutiny, they did it this way. Until the very last day, the bosses showed nothing but kindness, and you could only suppose that they were trying to decide which of their own number were to blame. But on the appointed day, as the work teams were passing through the gates, they noticed that the escort party which took charge of them was twice or three times its normal strength. The plan was to seize the victims where prisoners could not help one another, nor could the walls of huts or buildings under construction help them. The escort marched the columns out of the camp and took them by different ways into the steppe, but before they had brought any of them to their destination, the officers in command gave their orders. "Halt! Weapons at the ready! Chamber cartridges! Prisoners, sit down! I shall count to three and fire if you aren't sitting down! Everybody, sit!" Once again, as at Epiphany the year before, tricked and helpless, the slaves were pinned to the snow. Then, too, an officer had unfolded a piece of paper and read out the names and numbers of those who had to rise, leave the unresisting herd, and pass through the cordon. Next, this handful of mutineers was marched back under separate escort, or else a black mariah rolled up to collect them. The herd, now purged of fermenting agents, was then brought to its feet and driven to work. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.